I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Kevin Vallier, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Bowling Green State University. We're discussing his 2019 book, Must Politics Be War? Restoring Our Trust in the Open Society, from Oxford University Press. Vallier works on contemporary liberal political philosophy, ethics, and the philosophy of religion, and is the author of Liberal Politics and Public Faith Beyond Separation, as well as many articles. First of all, let me say, Kevin Vallier, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thank you for having me on.
Kevin, I really enjoyed the book. It's a really rigorous philosophical justification of liberalism based on the idea of trust. It's a sort of core concept that you develop there. And you also incorporate the empirical literature alongside the philosophical literature from liberal political philosophy very well. So nice work on that.
Oh, thank you.
I usually start off with asking the question about the motivation for the book. And in your case, it strikes me that I think it would be helpful for us maybe to disentangle what I take to be two motivations for the book. First of all, there's a motivation I think that's suggested in the title, which comes from contemporary politics.
Yes.
Must politics be war? That contemporary politics is so polarized that we're heading for something like civil war. And I wanted to actually kind of set that motivation aside for a second and just sort of jump in instead to the motivation with regard to the literature on contemporary liberal political philosophy, especially in the Rawlsian tradition, which your book is clearly a part of and aims to contribute to. So maybe you could say a little bit about what your motivation was here in that tradition, maybe what's missing in the Rawlsian tradition that you aim to sort of fill in, and what you take to be the signal contribution of the book in that tradition.
Oh, great. So the best way to explain the book is to think about it as developing themes that Rawls kind of left open at the end of his career. So if we go back, and I think your listeners will be somewhat familiar with the arguments of a theory of justice, one of the things that Rawls wants to do is he wants to show, particularly in the last third of the book that nobody reads, how living a good life is compatible with justice. And how does justice figure into what it makes sense for us to choose and to do? And the idea there is that Rawls articulated a series of goods that he thought justice was a part of or would interact positively with, that there'd be a kind of congruence or fit. So the idea is he's answering Plato's old question, why be just? And he's trying to explain the kinds of goods that living a just life in an unjust society realize. The trouble was that Rawls realized over time that the goods he pointed to were actually controversial, or at the very least, it was controversial to assume that they would have the proper weight in most people's deliberations, particularly with respect to religious people who would prioritize transcendent goods over the kind of more natural and earthly goods that he appealed to, like things like friendship and the pursuit of excellence. So what Rawls decided to do was to write another big book, this one, Political Liberalism, that came out some 20 years later. And the idea there was to try to show that we could pursue a just society even if we deeply disagreed about what was good. So the idea was that Kantians and utilitarians and Christians and Muslims can all appeal to their what he called comprehensive doctrine, but they could form what he called an overlapping consensus on a shared conception of justice. So the idea was you allow now the good to vary. And the hope is you can overlap on justice anyway. But then he started to think, and this came out in the introduction of the paperback edition, that people could disagree reasonably and honestly about justice as well. So the idea was to refit the story so that we could converge at least on a family of conceptions of justice, or maybe that there is a group of conceptions of justice that we could all overlap on, and for contingent reasons, our society chooses one rather than the other. However, the only way that Rawls could stop this from fundamentally disrupting his project was to limit the scope of reasonable disagreement about justice a lot more than he limits reasonable disagreement about the good. And the problem there is that he didn't ever really explain why this was. And I don't think contemporary Rawlsians have been able to give a very compelling answer to this problem. So suppose we're interested in trying to live together in diverse conditions, to pursue some goods and some aspects of justice together, but we reasonably disagree about justice as much as we reasonably disagree about the good. This means that the Rawlsian project has to shift away from justice in a certain way, in the same way that liberal theory, non-perfectionist liberal theory, shift away from basing the state and the concept of the good. So the thought is, well, if we disagree about the good and justice, what unites us? What brings us together? What is the relationship that we care about sustaining when our disagreements are so deep? In his 2011 book, The Order of Public Reason, Jerry Gauss, who's my dissertation advisor, tries to develop this idea of us maintaining what he calls moral relations with one another. And he outlines briefly what these moral relations might be, love, friendship, and trust. And he had said things about love and friendship in the past, but he said almost nothing about trust. And I go back to Rawls and I see there are little bits and pieces about trust there in political liberalism, but almost nothing. But it occurs to me, trust, social trust, particularly trust in most people, is the sort of moral relation that I think that we can hope to sustain despite our deep disagreements. And so if we can both look at the philosophy of trust and the social science of trust, we may be able to figure out how to justify a liberal order to maintain that broader moral relationship, one that's, I think, actually feasible under conditions of diversity and disagreement. So the point of the book is to say, what is this moral relation that we can have even when we disagree about the good and disagree about justice? And it turns out that relationship is trust, and it's something that we can study. It's something that we can actually show is feasible because it's measured and it's, you know, analyzed across a number of different fields. So what I'm trying to do is bring trust to the Public Reason Project in order to complete that long line of reasoning that Rawls got going 50 years ago.
I wanted to ask you before we moved on about maybe one of those post Rawlsian thinkers who tried to wrestle with this. So Jonathan Kwong in his in his book, maybe I should just say a little bit, and I apologize if this is too much inside baseball for people, but he tries to wrestle with this idea of the fact of reasonable pluralism about justice versus the fact of reasonable mm-hmm. pluralism about the good, and argues that, there's a sort of asymmetry there that mm-hmm. we actually in contemporary liberal societies have foundational disagreements about the good. That is, we don't share really premises in common. Mm-hmm. Whereas in liberal societies, we do, even though we disagree about justice, we do have some fundamental premises that we can kind of share in some rough ways. And maybe this is sort of the inheritance of that family of mm-hmm. views of justice that Rawls and Public Reason Revisited and elsewhere talks about. So, I mean, what do you think about that Kwong sure. approach? I mean, mm-hmm. it strikes me that part of it is, it might be in some way similar to yours. And when you get to the upshot of your discussion, when you talk about primary rights mm-hmm, mm-hmm. later in the book as a sort of way to sort of unite, say, social democrats and libertarians who have very different views of justice, well, they can kind of come together on primary rights. And that might be the, you know, what Kwong might say, you know, sort of the premises that you hold in common.
Yeah. I mean, John's a great philosopher, and his book, Liberalism Not Perfection, is really important. However, I do disagree with his response to what's called the asymmetry objection to political liberalism. That the objection just being, oh, political liberals don't treat disagreement about justice the same as they do about the good. And John does make the claim, which initially sounds empirical, that our disagreements about the good are deeper than our disagreements about justice. But if you look into it, it's not actually an empirical claim. John thinks that when we deeply disagree about justice, it's often the case that one or both sides are unreasonable. So the idea is that he says all disagreements about justice are going to be either not especially deep or they're going to involve unreasonableness, whereas the good won't. And I have two different essays on this. It's pretty easy to find on my CV because it talks about justice. One piece talks about justice pluralism and the other mentions John's work directly. And I think that what ends up happening is he wins the battle by stipulation. And so I think once you look into, well, why is John stipulating that disagreements about justice will tend to be shallow or they'll be unreasonable, is that there's just not very much motivation for that idea. He depends much too heavily on a kind of robust idea of the reasonable to do a great deal of theoretical work. And I think one of the biggest objections that non-Rawlsians have to Rawlsian political philosophy is that Rawlsians rely on this extremely robust and contentful notion of the reasonable without saying very much or enough to motivate it. And I actually kind of agree with that criticism. I think reasonableness can't achieve as much as Rawlsians think. But yes, it is true that in the end, I mean, John and I agree that there are some things that all reasonable people will acknowledge. But in my case, the amount of reasonable disagreement about justice is considerably larger. So while John hasn't written on this, Rawls did. Rawls argued that libertarianism was unreasonable. And I accept within the book that both versions of libertarianism and conservatism are reasonable, as well as left-wing views on justice. And this means that the primary rights or the kinds of rights I think we can overlap on are somewhat different than I think egalitarian liberal like John would think. In fact, quite different in some regards. Particularly the right to own capital, private right to own capital.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah, that's interesting. So yeah, I want to get there because it's a quite ambitious claim you make later. Yeah. So that's great. So let's start off by talking about trust, because that's core as you just core to your theory as you just introduced it, and it more or less comprises the first part of the book in which you set out to find a basis really for justifying social norms. This is a chapter on the social constitution of moral norms. I thought of it like the Lockean state of nature, except without the Lockean stuff about human nature. Instead, you know, all this stuff, all the normative matters are constructed on your view rather than sort of embedded in some kind of law of nature. But anyway, that was helpful for me to think about. So maybe you just start about by saying a bit about what you mean by trust and how it resolves disagreement in modern societies.
Sure. So the main idea with trust is that it's a kind of reliance that involves seeing others as morally responsible agents. So to trust someone, I have to depend on them to achieve one of my goals. I have to think that they're willing and able to engage in some action that facilitates the pursuit of my goals. But I can rely on my computer, I can rely on my car to do those things, but I don't trust them. To trust someone, I think, is to see them from a kind of Straussian participant stance. Trust can be disappointed or betrayed, and we take it to be pro tanto wrong when trust is betrayed or disappointed. We look for an excuse. So a system of trust where we trust one another is a kind of a system of accountability where we can direct the negative reactive attitudes of resentment and indignation to those who are untrustworthy, and we can blame and sanction or punish them in certain cases as well. So that's what I think trust is. It's a kind of moralized reliance. It's relying on those we see as moral agents. Social trust is social trust or trust that's placed in society by society, but not as a whole, but in the belief that most individuals will follow certain central social norms of their society. So analogy I use in this case is just the rules of traffic, particularly the ones that aren't legally enforced very often or at all. For instance, like allowing people to merge onto the interstate. A traffic system that's high in social trust is one that we can depend on one another and most people to follow those rules most of the time so that we can all get to our individual destinations. So when I think of social trust, it's trust that other people will tend to follow certain central moral rules of their society that are our kind of social norm. And on the count of social norms I draw on Christina Bicchieri's important work. So there's a bit about what I think trust is and a bit about what I think social trust is. And I think that one of the key features of the project is to stress just how important social trust is, and then to try to move to questions about how it can be sustained. So the main benefits of social trust are the ones that are documented in the empirical literature. I call the social value of social trust. Things like economic growth, more trusting societies tend to grow faster, more economic equality, more trusting societies allow more redistribution. You get a better functioning civil service, less corrupt legal systems. So there's all kinds of goods that come from high levels of social trust. There's also, I think, what I call the relational value, which is of social trust, which is that in high trust societies, you can form relations of love and friendship and sustain them with a wider array of people. Low trust societies tend to be high in particularized trust, which is, you know, trust in your clan or family. And you can form relations of love and friendship in those societies, but it's with a pretty small group of people. And if they leave the tribe, then, you know, the basis for those relations is reduced. So we want to have a system of trust. We want as much trust as we can have, but there's a problem. And the problem is that we cannot sustain a system of trust merely because we think that there are a lot of benefits to it. Because if we don't think that others are trustworthy, there's almost no way to convince ourselves to trust them, nor is there a good reason to do so because they might betray us. So in order to sustain a system of trust, we can't just say, oh, look how valuable it is. We have to appeal to people's motives to be trustworthy in the eyes of others. So I develop a notion that I call social trustworthiness, where it's just a disposition that people have to comply with the moral rules that are the object of social trust. You know, a socially trustworthy motorist is someone who tends to follow the rules of the road. So the question then arises, well, you know, what are the conditions under which it makes sense for people to be trustworthy? And when I flesh that out, then I start getting into the ideas of public reason and the standards of public reason that can then be used to justify liberal order. And that's sort of more the second half of the book. So the idea is to lay out a notion of trust, then develop a notion of social trust, speak to the value of social trust, but then point out that appealing to the value of trust alone is not enough to sustain it. And then we move into the story about how to sustain trustworthiness and the way that liberal societies can do that for people who have deeply divergent perspectives on morality, politics, and so on.
Yeah, and the chapter on trust and its benefits is quite interesting. I was thinking that, you know, one of the other great benefits of social capital, social trust is, you know, that it's in the empirical literature, it really is shown to benefit the less well-off, right? That it's mm-hmm. that the less well-off are the ones who are most damaged by systems of mistrust and low social capital. And it actually improves their conditions. So I found that very compelling. I wanted to ask, though, about the sort of transition from the teleological values of trust to the what you call the deontological values. Sure. Because yeah. I guess one of the questions that I had at this point in the book is sort of the basis of trust. It's sort of why is it that liberal citizens would come to support a system of trust? Because you can imagine, you know, on the one hand, your view something being something like a modus vivendi approach, that it's like, you know, well, we all accede to these social norms because it's all in our mutual self-interest. But on the other hand, it seems like you want to argue that it's there's more of a moral component to it, that we mm-hmm. that we do it for the right reasons, mm-hmm. And that we, you know, we owe respect to one another, and that's why we ought to trust them. So maybe you could just help me in thinking through, you know, sort of how you navigate this sort of self-interested modus vivendi approach to liberalism and the more sort of Rawlsian moralized conception.
Yeah, this is complex because there are a lot of philosophical pitfalls in working this out. What I take to be in common between Rawls and then the two sort of other great theorists of public reason, in my view, that have systems, Habermas and Gauss, is that they all want to try to show that the standards of evaluation from our order aren't things that are imposed from without by like a law of nature or some sort of objective moral principles, that there's some standard internal to our moral practices that we can articulate and then use to evaluate the social order. So there's a sense in which they're all kind of Hegelian in that regard, in the sense of coming up with norms of immanent criticism, that the norms are internal to the kind of society we want to maintain. And what I'm trying to do in grounding the idea of public justification and the idea that we can have an overlapping consensus on common norms and institutions, is I'm trying to do something similar. I'm trying to show that there's a kind of standard of justification that's built into the way that we ordinarily think about trust. And here's kind of how the story goes. Imagine that you knew someone who tended to do all the things that you counted on them for. And then you discover that they're a sociopath and that the only reason they're doing this is to lull you into a false sense of security in order to eventually betray you in the worst way. Or you learn that the only reason that they are reliable is because they're just really afraid of getting caught. Maybe they're being monitored in some way. In that case, I think it's really hard to sustain a trusting attitude because you, in the end, don't really know what to expect, or you know to expect bad things eventually. And the intuition here is supposed to be that when we trust others, we expect that their moral motive, that their reliable behavior is at least partly or largely motivated by moral considerations. That people do it because they think more or less that it's the right thing to do. The idea there is that trust has to be sustained based on a belief that others are acting from moral considerations. And the thought then is that when we maintain a system of trust within a diverse society, what we're thinking, what we're imagining, what we're presupposing is that each person's perspective furnishes them with adequate moral motivation to be trustworthy, even if those moral reasons and motives and values differ from one another. So what makes a society that forms an overlapping consensus on the basis of trust not a modus vivendi is that we see the trust as grounded in moral considerations and not merely self-interested ones. So I know that's a complex point because you have to buy into my view that trusting others involves belief in their having sort of moral motivations. But I think I can motivate that. So the idea is the standard of public justification will fall out of the ordinary way we think we would sustain trust in a diverse under diverse conditions.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking of the analogy with toleration as a liberal virtue in this context, that at least the sort of Lockean tradition would be to appeal to something like toleration. And in one sense, you can see toleration as self-interested, right? That, you know, if you're a Catholic or a Protestant in the early modern period, it looks pretty good to your own self-interest to tolerate one another. But at the same time, at least Locke's point is that toleration has there's a moral component to it, just to put it in those terms, that, yeah, I mean, at least to take just one of Locke's arguments, coerced faith is not true faith, right? Mm-hmm. So that, you know, that you ought to tolerate, that is not coerce your religious opponent, because to coerce them is actually to undermine your own very project, or is to violate your very moral project. So, yeah, I'm wondering if that's the right kind of analogy. I mean, part of it was I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, you start with trust. Why not appeal to toleration?
Well, interesting thing that you bring up Locke. A very understudied dimension of Locke is his idea of a public trust, which is all over the second treatise. And the way that he sees the social contract is forming is it forms a kind of public trust, a series of norms that we rely on our leaders and powerful members of society to abide by. And that I think without trust, toleration doesn't really make sense because you just don't know what to expect from others and you don't know if bad things are going to come from them or not. So trust is going to turn out to be an enabling condition for all kinds of moral relationships and moral ideals. Trust is so foundational to social order that if you're not in a system of trust, you're essentially in a state of war. And in that society, we may think, okay, in a state of peace, I should be tolerant, but these people are going to kill me, right? So, you know, that's what I also say to people who say, well, why not appeal to civic friendship? And I say, well, look, you can't have friendship without trust either.
Right.
So all
that seems like the basic concept, found underneath those other ones,
That's right. So it's the sort of font of social order, and that's something we can look not just know philosophically, but that we can know empirically as well.
I was going to ask about the limits of trust because it strikes me that it's not always a good thing to trust right. others, or it's not always clear that maybe a system of trust is the right thing, or you know, we trusting somebody would lull us into a false sense of security. Yeah. I mean, I was thinking in terms of, I mean, I'm sure there are lots of examples here, but sort of power inequalities. It's all well and good for equals to trust one another, but what if, is it good for people who are less powerful to trust, maintain a system of trust with people who are more powerful? Just to take a provocative example, you know, if an African American gets pulled over by a police officer, you know, I'm just wondering about how to think about, you know, whether trust is warranted or what how to think about that kind of situation.
Yeah. So this is also complex because it appeals to both the kind of teleological or sort of instrumental benefits and the sort of deontological considerations. So we want to trust people when they're trustworthy. And that's partly for the teleological reasons, is that, you know, trust has all kinds of good effects. And also we think it's sort of rationally warranted in itself. But once we have relations of trust with other people, even people that are more powerful than us, there are certain kinds of deontological or respect-based considerations that will come into play, particularly that we'll ordinarily think we have a duty to be trustworthy to others, and that we will confine our practice of, we'll sort of treat others as trustworthy. We're only going to hold them accountable to violations when we think it's appropriate. Once we recognize the interplay of those considerations, we'll see the way that a kind of public justification requirement is grounded, that to maintain trust, we need an overlapping consensus on common norms from different perspectives. So when you look at cases of power inequalities, then they can only be legitimized within a system of trust if they are based on practices on which there's an overlapping consensus. So that's going to rule out all kinds of power inequalities, because the people who are dominated are going to have defeater reasons or adequate reason to reject the relevant norms. So there won't be an overlapping consensus. And so trust, oppressive relationships will undermine trust. And I think that's actually pretty intuitive. So let's just think about it in a very generic way, where you have a political hegemon. They don't care about public justification. They're going to impose their values regardless of whether different people can overlap on it. This creates two relationships or two grounds for distrust. The first ground is between the hegemon and the subverted group, because as soon as the hegemon looks in the other direction, the subverted group is going to disobey, so long as they can get away with it, because they see the values as alien. They don't see sufficient moral reason to go along with it. But there's also a source of distrust between the subverted and the hegemon, right? The subverted group isn't going to trust the hegemon because the hegemon's completely indifferent to their fundamental values, or at least largely so. So when you have, say, a hegemonic power group like, you know, an unjust level of police authority with a vulnerable portion of the population, we can show with the public justification standard that the conditions for justified or trust have broken down. And so I think that's the way in which, and again, it involves appealing to both the evaluative sort of teleological considerations and the deontological ones, that you can use the moral elements within a system of trust to critique power inequalities and to overthrow them.
Yeah, that's interesting how you put that sort of trust breaking down, because I would expect it to be,
and that's empirically the other way around, too, right? I mean, marginalized communities, trust is often, a social trust even, is often lower.
Right. Right.
And often that's because of corruption in the legal system. It turns out there's a pretty tight correlation between trust in the legal system, trust in most people.
Right. I guess what I would have assumed that is that it would go the other way, that you don't, it's not like you start with a system of trust and then it breaks down, but that, you know, trust is in some way an achievement of, mm-hmm. I mean, it's different. I mean, I don't know, maybe this is a pessimistic view of human nature, but it strikes me that human societies tend to begin under conditions of tremendous oppression and inequality and corruption and so forth, and that the tendency has to be towards establishing equality and rights and systems of trust, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know how you, I mean, is that the way you think about it, that sort of trust is an achievement, or is it that it's a kind of beginning standard condition for human societies?
So trust comes in degrees, And I think you have to have a certain level of social trust to get beyond the tribe. And we don't really know where it came from, social trust. In fact, there's going to be a conference in Sweden on this. There's a lot of trust researchers in Scandinavian countries, in part because they have gigantic levels of trust. And we don't really know why some societies are more socially trusting than others. I have a kind of account of part of the explanation. But for whatever reason, we were able to get beyond trust only in the tribe or the family. And it was, you know, by bits and pieces that we were able to get there through the development of history. But we haven't been systematically measuring social trust for more than, say, 40 years. The United States, we've been doing it since 1958 or so. So we don't really know very much about trust levels. But what I think is plausible is that large-scale societies presuppose a certain degree of social trust, but that there are feasible ways of increasing those trust levels with certain kinds of reforms. So what I'm imagining is that there's sort of, you're sort of right that you need a, there's, you know, higher levels of trust or social achievements, but the lower levels of trust are things that I think have to be in place for things to even get off the ground. And of course, it's also the case that states will sometimes destroy their trust levels. Empirically, we know this from communist countries in large part because of secret police. At least this is my hypothesis. So, you know, East German social trust is still lower than West German social trust. When it's plausibly, it was probably pretty unified before the Second World War in terms of trust levels. And even in 1989, I think as many as 5% of East Germans were members of the secret police. So imagine, you know, one out of every 20 adults is a police officer that you meet and you don't know. And they could send you, you know, make a report on you and you wouldn't really have a chance to defend yourself against it. In that case, that's going to undermine social trust. And that's a way a state destroys social trust. Massive famines and big failures like that. So the areas of famine in China, for instance, even to this day, have lower levels of political trust than other areas. So the answer to your question is you need a certain level of trust to get these kind of questions off the ground for there to be mass societies. But you have to bring about more trust in certain ways, and there's also the danger that states of certain kinds will tend to destroy or undermine the trust that's already there. So maintaining trust is a social achievement, and increasing trust is a social achievement.
Let's turn to trust and public reason,
because
this is the next step in it. I mean, I wanted to ask you about the, I guess, the relationship between trust and public reason,
how
trust ground, is it a sort of grounding or a guiding relationship? How to think about that?
Yeah, this is pretty intricate as well. I don't know what it is about public reason views, but they always have a lot of moving parts. And I've been studying public reason for about 15 years now, and I still don't entirely know why. Rawls's book is 500 pages. Habermas's main book is 500 pages. Gauss's book is 600 pages. Mine is 250, so I have to compact things, not to really compare myself with them, but I'm building on what they're saying and trying to add a little bit to it, not create a whole new system. This argument has a couple of different steps. So remember that I said a system of trust is a system of accountability, and to hold others accountable, we need to think that they're culpable for violations, right? I mean, when I say, look, you did the wrong thing, I need to think one of two things, either that you knew better than to act as you did, or that you, in some sense, should have known better. And that's a really important point, should have known better. Because what we're saying, essentially, is that people's reasons to be trustworthy and their reasons to hold others accountable are sensitive to considerations beyond what most people presently accept. So when I'm deciding whether to trust you or to be trustworthy or to hold people accountable, when I'm trying to figure out when I or others have reason to do this, we can't just appeal to our present acceptances, because that's inconsistent with our practice. We say, look, here are the things you should have known that you don't currently know. This is sometimes called the epistemic condition on moral responsibility, and there's been some work on it lately. And I like the idea that what we're essentially doing when we're saying, look, these are things you should have known, is we're implicitly appealing in our moral practice to a kind of idealization. We're saying, look, there's certain kinds of inferences you should have conducted. There's certain kinds of information that you should have collected. And what that means is that when we're trying to establish certain norms as objects of trust, we're essentially going to be holding people to the norms based on reasons that aren't entirely clear to them all the time. And that means that we can appeal not just to what they say or presently accept, but to what their personal reasons are. Okay, so now suppose that I'm right then that trust and establishing trust involves appealing to people's reasons grounded in their agency, but not just in whatever they say they accept or not. Those reasons will be what I call the justificatory reasons, the reasons that can justify the relevant norms to each person, those appealed to with the relevant idealization. This will furnish diverse reasons that people have, each person having sufficient reason of their own to adopt and internalize the relevant rules and norms. Now, what's significant about that is a kind of overlapping consensus. That's a kind of what I call public justification. Now everyone's going to say, oh, wait, you're just talking about overlapping consensus. You're not talking about public reason. And that's because public reason involves public reasons, meaning reasons that are shared. But all you're talking about is diverse reasons. And I admit, I have a non-standard conception of public justification here because I prioritize the overlapping consensus as the foundational normative kind of public justification. Appealing to shared reasons may help, but it's not essential. So when I say that I'm a public reason liberal, I mean that I think that the kinds of authority that we claim over one another have to be justifiable to all members of the public on their own terms. So we aren't limited to shared reasons. So I still think that's a public reason view. Some people say that's not a public reason view. And I say, okay, well, this is essentially a semantic dispute. So what I'm essentially doing is I'm grounding an overlapping consensus kind of justification, a kind of overlapping consensus justificatory standard, what I call a public justification principle, in the standards implicit in our practice of trust. And that's to appeal to this idea of people's reasons and not just their present acceptances in sustaining the accountability relations that are constitutive of the system of trust. So I know there's a couple of different moves there, but that's the basic idea. Understanding public justification is a kind of overlapping consensus requirement. Understanding our practice of trust is supposing that people act and are motivated by reasons, allowing those reasons to vary. And then trying to say that the overlapping consensus requirement is an articulation of the standard implicit in our practice. Because again, as I said, following Rawls, Habermas, and Gauss, public justification, if we're not going to ground it in some controversial notion of the law of nature or moral reality, the standard has to be one of immanent criticism. It has to arise from within our social practices. And for me, it has to arise from within our trust practices.
Yeah, that's good. I was thinking, several things here. One is, I was wondering about if there's any relationship on your view between the at the beginning when we were earlier talking about trust, mm-hmm. to distinguish between trusting another person and the sort of system of social trust. Mm-hmm. And when you go to public reason, the public reason discussion, mm-hmm. You shifted over into that social trust because the object of public reason seems to be those social norms that systems mm-hmm. of trust are built up around. I'm just wondering what happens if there's any room or role remaining for that, the trust of individuals, because as you point out in the book, it's all well and good to sort of trust people based on the social norms that they profess to. But as we all know, individuals can be hypocrites. They can profess to something and then in private do something quite different. And so it's often trust breaks down not because of sort of unjust or wrong social norms, but because of the sort of deceptive comportment that individuals take.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's critical that people violate social norms all the time. And any good theory of public reason has to recognize that. So this is one reason that I characterize myself as working within non-ideal theory. So I'm impressed about that, that I don't presume that there's compliance with the relevant norms in the way that Rawls does. And Rawls, I mean, sometimes it's sometimes people characterize Rawls's compliance assumption as overly extreme. It's not complete unconditional compliance, even for Rawls, because there's things like the strains of commitment where certain norms can be too demanding of our good. So even Rawls doesn't assume unconditional compliance. So if you allow non-compliance, well, then what you have to introduce is a system of sanction and punishments for when there are norm violations. And that's part of the story. It's built into part of the story that when people violate the relevant norms, that we hold them and accountable. And this is just, you know, well studied in the social norms literature. Actually, the biggest challenge for my view is not that people will disobey the norms, that they won't obey them often enough, but that they'll obey them too often. Mm-hmm. Sometimes social norms can be so deeply ingrained, people will go along with them even when they can't see sufficient moral reason to go to because they're terrified of social disapproval, mm-hmm. not just like going to jail. They just don't want others to think less of them, that people will want to avoid shame, which, I mean, they may avoid guilt, right? Because they think, well, I really didn't do anything wrong. But they'll feel shame. They'll say, others think less of me. I've been dishonored in some way. So we have a system of sanctions in place for people who violate norms. It's difficult to hold powerful people accountable, but that's part of the reasons we have legal systems and political systems, is because that's one of the ways we hold the powerful accountable, is by concentrating power in the people so that they can resist, even though that doesn't always work, obviously. Yeah, I mean, I think that what's going on with the system of trust is you have a built-in system of punishment and sanction that can malfunction in lots of ways, which is the way I justify legal and political order, is a way to improve upon that order. So fortunately, already built into the idea of trust is the idea of punishment and sanction being apt in cases of untrustworthy behavior. So in that way, again, the compliance idea is kind of internal to the practice of trust. So that's the...
Yeah,
that's the hope, is that I've already got non-compliance built in at the ground floor.
Yeah, and that's helpful what you last said about too much compliance, because this fits in well with, you know, say, the feminist literature on the ways that gender norms sort of are enforced through.
Oh man, through that there.
Good.
Yeah, no, it's essential. I mean, two of the social norm cases of people complying too much that I talk about are female genital cutting and foot binding.
Yeah.
That Bicchieri talks about, where, and particularly with current female genital cutting, you have surveys of whether people approve of it or think it's required. And there are countries where, particularly Burkina Faso, where the approval of female genital cutting is below 50%, but female genital cutting is over 50%. That means there's a huge portion of the population that's submitting or imposing mutilation when they don't want to do it, simply because they think that others expect that of them, the high status members of their society, or they're trying to make sure their daughters can marry well, lest, you know, a man recoil from his wife on the wedding night. Social norms can be so deeply ingrained that they're extremely oppressive. And that's part of the rationale for legal order, is to help to reshape the mere moral order, precisely because of those patterns of oppression.
Yeah. So how do you analyze that in terms of public reason? I mean, I'm also thinking of cases of use, say, like false consciousness too, where it's, mm-hmm. I mean, I take it in the case that you just mentioned about female genital cutting, there's at least some basis for,
that's right,
a critical lens, and you have people saying we don't like it. But, mm-hmm. you know, there are other cases where you say in the feminist literature, you talk about, you know, some gender norms are so mm-hmm. deeply ingrained that, that, you know, you survey women and they'll say, yes, mm-hmm. I love 3-inch high heels or whatever, you know, whatever, pick your example, or, you know, so how do you tend to analyze those things? And is this under in terms of the sort of moderate mm-hmm. idealization mm-hmm. that you take up?
I mean, this is a tough issue, and I don't talk about false consciousness in this book because I wanted to write a shorter public reason book.
Yeah.
And that meant cutting some things out, but there's going to be a sequel to the book because I have more to say, and I couldn't bear not to say it. So false consciousness is hard on a public reason view because on the one hand, there are cases of false consciousness that I think will be captured and exposed as such by moderate idealization, where we say, okay, these are things that they endorse, but not at a very deep level. And that if you kind of let off the oppression and the violence and the threats, the relevant attitudes will break down pretty quickly because you think they might be based in like gross misinformation. So take about, you know, female genital cutting. I mean, one of the things that people try to do to eliminate these norms is to just to publicize how unpopular they are. So in some cases, you know, I think moderate idealization will involve attributing to the women that submit to this adequate information to know that most people don't even want it done. Right. And to understand the basic health costs and the cost of, you know, personal flourishing that comes from losing that capacity. So I think in those cases that the women will see themselves as having sufficient reason to object to the norm. But of course, you know, there are lots of cases where people have deeply and personally internalized patriarchal relationships. And as, for instance, most adherents of all the major world religions. I mean, gender hierarchy is deeply ingrained portion of most world religions' historical practices. And many of these traditions give moral reasons for thinking that those are the relevant relationships. And in that case, you might think, oh, that's ultimately false consciousness because the religion is false and it's the opiate of the people or something like that. But I don't think that we want a public reason view to be involved in kind of reaching deep into people's commitments that way and saying they're oppressive and should be overturned. That starts to look to me illiberal and overly perfectionist. And so there will be forms of false consciousness where people's norms are deeply internalized that I think it is inappropriate to try to disrupt by means other than persuasion. So there will be cases of false consciousness where, you know, you tolerate certain patriarchal relationships because they're deeply ingrained and internalized, but they're done sincerely. So this is why for Rawls, he wants to say, look, liberal order can tolerate traditional gender roles to some degree. And this was something that people pushed Rawls on and that he addresses an idea of public reason revisited because I think he felt like he didn't know what to say for a while. So I think ultimately the public reason view says we can overturn and fight certain kinds of false consciousness that are relatively shallow in people's deliberative commitments. But the ones that are relatively deep and sincere are ones that we're not going to see, say, the state or the legal order is having reason to alter. And I think that's just an articulation of the liberal idea, right? I mean, that we just respect people who have different kinds of views. So in some ways it's a bullet to bite him, but in some ways I don't think that it is. The real worry for me is if there were cases of sort of remarkable damaging false consciousness that the theory of idealization couldn't address. And maybe there are some, but hopefully my friends Lori Watson and Christy Hartley, who are working on feminism and my view, will help me to see those cases clearly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and can you say maybe just say briefly about the idea of moderate idealization?
Yeah, sure.
Because it's sure. It may seem a little fuzzy. I mean, in part, you know, how do you don't want to have too much idealization like Rawls does, right. But you don't want to be too realist. Yeah. I mean, so how do you know, if you've strayed too far on the idealization spectrum?
Yeah, so this actually has come up in two of the reviews of the book. I, in my very first book on religion and politics, which was about the application of public reason to the very specific religion and politics questions, developed a theory of moderate idealization at some length. And in trying to figure out how long the book should be, I thought, okay, well, I could go through the whole theory again because my views about the details haven't changed on that particular thing, haven't changed very much. Or I could just cite it. I think now that I should have put more in it than just citing the previous book than I did, because this has come up for a couple of different times. So in trying to keep the book short, I think I probably removed too much of the theory. So let me just try to outline it in general detail. And then, you know, if people want to look into the theory in the other book, that they can. So just to say to the listeners, it's worked out. So for me, there's three dimensions of idealization that we have to appeal to. Rationality, information, and coherence. So the rationality dimension is a measure of inferential success. It's how able and often am I drawing the right conclusions from the relevant premises? The information standard has to do with how much information we give to people that is necessary to think that the reasons that the idealization spits out are genuine reasons for them. So, you know, as I said before, you know, we oftentimes say that people's reasons are dependent upon information that they don't have access to. And then finally, there's a standard of coherence. You might think that you have a lot of information and inferential success, but it turns out the conclusions of different arguments are grossly inconsistent with one another. So the idea in that case is that you generate a certain degree of coherence by saying that people are going to kind of harmonize these different judgments, you know, which is, I think, partly reflected in Rawls's idea of a reflective equilibrium. So those are all the dimensions or the knobs of idealization. And, you know, you can turn it up and give people perfect inferential success. You can give them perfect full information. And you can give them complete global coherence so that there are no inconsistencies, either in terms of logical conflict or even credence levels. So everything sort of fits together. Or you could do none of those things. And I think both of those would be really bad ways of thinking about what our ultimate reasons to act are. You know, if we attribute, for instance, we make people's beliefs, we give them all the relevant information, we give them all the relevant inference making, and give them all the relevant level of coherence, it's probably the case that the vast majority of people's deep commitments and values are going to be revised and rejected. So if we're trying to articulate a standard for the kinds of reasons that ground our accountability relations with one another, we just can't appeal to that much idealization. What we have to do instead is try to articulate what are these kind of duties of inquiry that we assume that most people have, and when we apply that, what are the kinds of information that we tend to attribute to people? So this requires a bit of empirical examination in terms of, you know, we say, okay, look, there is a certain level of inferential success we hold people to. There is a certain level of information collection that we hold people to, and there is a certain level of consistency in people's beliefs and conclusions of their argument that people appeal to. So the thought is that when we look to our practice of accountability, we will see that we hold people responsible to engage in a moderate amount of each of these ideas of rationality, information, and coherence. As far as setting those levels very precisely, what I say in the first book is that it's hard to do very precisely, but the hope is that if people identify different sort of levels of rationality, information, coherence in the middle range, that they'll tend to yield similar models and results. And the hope is that when people articulate those different moderate standards, that they'll tend to agree more than they disagree. So that is a punt in the first book. But I think it's a fair one because there are so few theories of moderate idealization in the literature. There's really just Jerry and me, actually, pretty much that's it. I think it's fair to remain a little noncommittal on that and say we're going to have to do some sort of sociological empirical examination to sort of figure out the precise way in which our moral practices commit us to those three dimensions of idealization. So it's going to be partly an empirical inquiry, partly a philosophical inquiry. I don't know how much precision we're going to be able to get, but what I'm sure of is that we have to appeal to idealization and that we can't appeal to too much. So hopefully that helps.
Yes, it does. So let's move on to the second part of the book, which is shifts basically from the state of nature to civil society, I guess, to use Locke's term. Right. So you discuss the political constitution, constructing the political, justifying the liberal political constitution. And like Locke, the transition that you make is you know, to recognize that there are certain inconveniences that exist in the state of nature.
That's correct.
So what are the limitations to the social constitution of the state of nature that that can be supplemented or provided by politics.
So Rawls, in a few of his essays, used this term that that Gauss picked up and that I like, called a society's moral constitution. And in my view, the society's moral constitution is its whole set of sort of social norms that are sort of moral in character. And when I imagine a kind of state of nature, I'm not imagining there being only private judgment about the natural law in the way that that Locke imagines. I'm imagining that there's lots of shared public norms, but that all we have are those. So this is what I call in the book a legal state of nature. We imagine, say, aliens come to Earth, they abolish all legislatures and nation states, they abolish all formal legal systems, judges, police, but they leave us with the sort of court of public opinion, and they leave us with sort of social norms. So there are going to be three problems in the legal state of nature. First, there are going to be norms that stick around too long, that are oppressive. The other is that we're either not going to be able to keep norms around long enough or even develop them in the first place. And another problem is just that the court of public opinion is not so great. people make all kinds of rash decisions. And I think just about anybody would rather be in a trial of their peers with a jury than, you know, to be tried on a TV show that everybody's watching and getting hysterical about. So the idea is, you know, like the Casey Anthony trial, where, you know, every, you know, the news media cycle had everybody whipped up into a frenzy. And then the jury came out with a different decision. And I think, you know, in retrospect, you know, it's, I'm glad in those cases we have juries, because otherwise we would have a kind of nasty mob rule. So the thought is that in those situations, even moderately idealized agents can detect obvious problems. And as a result, they will be open to being coerced by the law if they can see that the legal order will be an improvement on the moral order, that the legal constitution will be an improvement on the moral constitution. So that's how we start to publicly justify the law. And many people listening are saying, I thought public reason was just about the law. And the answer in the sort of the Gaussian paradigm in which I work is, well, no, actually, public reason is about the moral constitution as a whole, and there's a way of looking at Rawls where that's a direction that Rawls could have gone in very easily. So the thought here is that we proceed from the moral order to the legal order, understanding the legal order as a supplement to the moral order, understanding legal coercion as improving the social order beyond the moral constitution. But that only gives us the legal order. So this is I draw a distinction between the legal and constitutional orders. Legal order is just what laws are interpreted and enforced, say, by the judicial system and the criminal justice system, right, or in the police. But there's also our need to change the law, and that's where politics comes in. In reaching into civil society and making certain kinds of alterations, imposing laws and policies and changing and revising them. And so what we need to justify there are what I call constitutional rules. They're rules that specify when the law can be changed and who can change them. And we publicly justify constitutional rules in a way parallel to the way that we publicly justify legal rules. So imagine we have what I call a state of mere law or a political state of nature. The aliens let up. They say, look, you can now have police and courts, but you can't change the law at all in any formal way. So there have been societies, I think, that are sort of like this. So you think about ancient Israelite culture, where the belief was that God had handed down the law. So this is something Michael Walzer points out in his book on the political theory of the Hebrew Bible, where he says, look, there's a well-developed theory of law, but the ancient Israelites don't have a theory of politics in the way the ancient Greeks did, because they didn't think the law was something that could be changed, just articulated. But I think since most of us don't think most of our laws are divinely inspired, even any religious people for that matter, our laws are made by flawed human beings, we will see that we need to change the law for similar reasons that we need to be able to alter the moral order. Bad laws can stick around too long, good laws can be too hard to get, and there are ways in which the judicial system and the police may not be adequately equipped to develop the law in the appropriate way. In particular, because they're not democratic. So the idea of a democratic constitution is that people have some kind of input into the shape of the legal and moral orders. So that's how we get to constitutional rules. And the main constitutional rules are those that articulate, codify, protect, and in some ways modify basic rights.
Right.
And that's how we try to get to a political order. So there's a three-layer model of public justification that you have moral rules at the bottom, legal rules in the middle layer, and then constitutional rules kind of at the top.
And good. So I wanted to get into this because you have ultimately what I take to be, maybe this is unfair, but somewhat of a thin conception of the contracting agents in this political mm-hmm. society would agree to, namely the kind of primary rights. And I'll ask you about the primary rights in a second. But one of the things you say before that is that the contracting agents in liberal society won't impose sectarian views about the good uh-huh. or about mm-hmm. justice, but mm-hmm. will sort of back away and circle around primary rights. I wanted to push you on that for a second because I mean, first of all, we can talk in a little bit about contemporary American liberalism, which seems like we are moving in the opposite direction to that, not mm-hmm. Away from just circling around primary rights and towards more sectarianism. But I guess the deeper question is, why not bring in some sectarian views? Because it strikes me that a society that shares a thicker conception of justice or indeed of the good actually can foster trust mm-hmm. in a much mm-hmm. more thoroughgoing and deep way than a society that's just bound together by a sort of thin set of rights, right? So that in the ancient nation of Israel, right, is bound together by a quite a thick conception of the good, and there is quite widespread forms of trust there. I mean, they'll break down too in some of the stories, but that's a lot of trust that's going on in that society. So I guess I'm wondering about that. There seems to be kind of trade-off here, right, uh-huh. between trust and the thick and thin views of moral norms.
Okay, so that's a great question, and it's there is a part of the book where I speak to this, maybe not as direct as I could have, which is that the theory I'm developing is not a theory of how to maximize trust, because there are certain deontic constraints on the way that we can bring trust about and that we think are morally appropriate. So, for instance, we could maximize trust perhaps with propaganda and manipulation,
right?
But there are certain standards of respect internal to the system of trust where those aren't the ways that we ordinarily think it's appropriate to sustain it. So if it were a mere maximizing theory, that would be a very powerful objection. However, there's a less powerful version of the objection that's still pretty powerful, which is that, sure, people are going to give priority to certain kinds of respect-based considerations, but they're not absolute, right? I mean, they don't override everything. So maybe, there is some margin where you could gain a lot of trust for a little less respect. And that would be helpful.
Or bring a few more perfection, some perfectionist liberal.
Sure. Perfectionism could do this. Manipulation could do this. Propaganda. I mean, all kinds of things could do it. And the public justification constraint speaks against all of them, but that might be overridden. And I actually have, there's a couple of things I want to see here. I think part of that is in fact an empirical claim about how often there'll be a temptation to override the kind of respect-based reasons with these kinds of worries that we're sacrificing too much trust by not having a thicker common good or something along those lines. And the idea there, I'm going to precisely how to put this, is to argue that in fact the hegemonic societies, empirically speaking, aren't really higher trust, or if they are, they pursue means that we pretty much agree are problematic. So for instance, China's very, very high political trust in the national government, but it's almost certainly not for good reasons, if people are even telling surveyors the truth. So part of it's to make the empirical argument, and that's one reason I wrote the sequel to the book, to get a lot more knee-deep in the empirical literature to say, actually, look, the thinner liberal institutions are the ones that play the largest role in sustaining trust. It's not the big shared values. However, there's a new paper from a trust researcher who I think the world of, Christian Bjornskov, And he found, this is preliminary, that social trust in Catalonia went up during the fight for secession. That attempts to create national identity increase social trust. We don't really know how to increase social trust. So that would be a case where you might think, well, maybe promoting national identity is a way of promoting trust. Here's another thing that speaks against my view, which is that it does look like massive immigration does reduce trust in government and tends to produce more populist voting. So you might think immigration restrictions would help to promote trust. So let's pursue this idea of a kind of populism. It could be maybe some left-wing and right-wing bits where we try to foster a national identity. We keep out people that have very different values in order to maintain trust levels. Could we get more trust in that system? Sure. Probably. I mean, I'm not, you know, totally, I would want to see the data before I went there, right? Went to that kind of populism. So I acknowledge that it's possible in principle. I just think it requires means that we ordinarily think are inappropriate or can't be justified or incompatible with respect for other persons. So that's the thought. Is, yeah, you can maximize trust, and sometimes there are consequences that would override the kind of respect that public justification manifests. But I'd like to see the data on it. I acknowledge that there could be, on the one hand. But I think that when you actually get into the proposals that would be effective, they start to look pretty morally untoward, even I think in many ways to non-liberals. So for instance, particularly breaking down religious toleration, if someone wants to say have a Catholic state or an Islamic state or something like that, and they want to use a lot of violence to impose it, the people in the hegemonic group may not mind it, but just about everyone outside is going to have a problem with it.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like one of the trade-offs here would be the form of trust that you're talking about, which is a kind of trust for the right reasons, you know, a trust worthy of the name or something like that, versus a form of trust that we say, yeah, I mean, it trust that's sort of formed maybe for the wrong reasons, trust that's forged out of a common sense of, you know, the example that you use, that sort of populist anti-immigrant example is the right kind of one. But I guess I wonder with that, of course we can say, I mean, this is trust for the wrong reasons. We might not, but you know, I wonder if at some point these are features of human nature that's difficult to overcome. And that's, should be accounted for, I suppose, in the kind of calculation of how we trade off with regard to these sorts of things.
Yeah, I mean, in a way to make that objection even more powerful is to say that there's a certain kind of tribalism or in-group component of our moral nature. And if we're articulating our moral practices and our standards of immanent criticism, then we ought to appeal to those dimensions of human nature as well. I don't get into this very much in this book. There's probably a page on it, but it's going to be a much bigger part of the next book, which is that this is the role that I think a liberal society can fulfill by having robust freedom of association. You can capture people's sort of tribal impulses within the liberal state so that they don't undermine trust, because liberal states are actually pretty good at maintaining freedom of association vis-a-vis other societies. So the idea is to take on our tribal natures and to allow them a certain range of movement, but to not allow them to undermine the sort of liberal order as a whole. So the hope is that, and I really, really, really wanted a federalism chapter in this book, and even in the sequel. I even have one written up, but I think federalism is going to play a role. There's just not enough data on it to really be able to say much of anything decisive. So the hope, though, is that between robust freedom of association and federalism, we can accommodate these impulses, allow people to live them out, respect them, honor them, without undermining liberal order itself. And I think, you know, I mean, freedom of association is pretty integral to the liberal idea. So I don't think it's untrue to liberalism or a sacrifice of liberalism to allow for robust freedom of association. Though, of course, liberals do deeply disagree about how much leeway to give to associations. And that is a big rift within the liberal tradition.
Yeah. So let's finish up. I mean, because my question about your view of primary rights sort of surrounds that last issue, which you just brought up. And maybe you could just start off just saying a little bit about what you mean by primary rights, and then talk, since time's running short, I'll just throw out there what I have in mind, which is, I guess, my worries about how you can get divergent views of justice to agree about something that's even substantively useful to talk about in terms of rights. So the example, I guess, that comes to mind is a libertarian and a social democrat to say, how is it that, what is it that they can agree about with primary rights? We have this disagreement in contemporary culture wars, I think, between forms of personal and collective responsibility. And these are related to issues of freedom of association and anti-discrimination in the workplace and so forth and so on. And the libertarian side of things, which would emphasize greatly the freedom of association and the rights on that side. On the other side is, in some ways, a very opposite view, which takes a much more restrictionist view on the freedom of association. So I guess I'm just perhaps a little bit more pessimistic about the possibility of sort of coming to some kind of consensus on anything substantive about rights, especially given, as you say, the context of the book, which is the growing polarization in American society.
Yeah. So, this is good. And in fact, it's a big enough problem to where the sequel is going to discuss it at great length. I think that because that book is doing a lot more to try to build in the empirical literature, one of the things I try... So just first a bit about primary rights. I call on primary rights to build on Rawls's idea of primary goods, which for Rawls, very roughly, are the goods that anyone with a rational plan of life would want for themselves. For me, primary rights are the rights that any person would want to realize their conceptions of the good and justice that they would be willing to extend to others on reciprocal terms. So what are the rights that people would say, okay, on the one hand, I really need them to pursue the right and the good. On the other hand, I'm willing to give them to others in the same amount. So the idea with the libertarian and the social democrat is to say, well, they both do acknowledge in the end that having some assignment of property rights is better than none. They do think that, it's important enough to live together with one another that there are some things that they are willing to compromise on. So the idea is that there are certain arrangements that both will see as moral, but, and this is key, morally suboptimal. So they say, look, this is something that's good enough that I can give my allegiance to it, but it's not fully just and it's not the best. So the thought is that where the social democrat and the libertarian will agree is in deciding on at least some rights where they will both think, well, maybe this isn't the best, but we need to get along, and so we have to have some kind of moral basis, even if it's suboptimal from our own moral perspectives.
So everybody will agree, but everybody will be disappointed.
Yes.
Okay.
In many cases, they'll agree. But the idea is that, we already think this way about the good, right? I mean, Christians and atheists realize, well, I don't have everything that I want. I wish everybody agreed with me and the law would support my view, but I can live with it, right? And I think people can learn to live with these disagreements about justice in the same way. So here are some things I think that are important. Rawls himself thought that there was a right to own personal property as long as it wasn't used as a productive asset, and that there should be freedom of occupation. The state shouldn't tell people what job to have. So I think right there, those are places where, and he's extremely egalitarian. He's not just a social democrat, where there's at least some property norms, because that's where the big dispute is, right, that are what we might call eligible for public justification. The question is, how much further than that can we go? And I think that if you look into what social democrats say, the problem has not usually been with private property and capital as such. The socialists even don't really have a problem with the mom and pop store, right? I mean, the problem is with the big concentrations of capital. It's the big businesses. It's the boss-owned businesses. That's really where the dispute between the left and the right, I think, lies is how much can you assign private property rights and then think that through spontaneous order you'll tend to get liberal outcomes, or if you give these large concentrations of capital property rights, they'll tend to produce spontaneous disorder and various kinds of immorality and injustice. That's something that reasonable people are going to disagree about. And so there need to be to come to some kind of arrangement where they say, okay, we can move forward. And I think in those cases, at least with respect to some rights of large corporations, that will be have to let up to the democratic process. And the social democrat and the libertarian will kind of have to let things fall where they may within that process. So, for instance, I think there's a lot of ambiguity in industrial policy about, say, how can the state intervene to ensure that workers have a certain share in governance? And in the next book, I'm going to go into a lot more detail about this, particularly in light of proposals like Elizabeth Warren's, but also something that Liz Anderson has pushed, where I want to resist the hardcore egalitarian view that, oh, no, we would reject any property rights in capital, but allow for the view that, you know, you can encourage workers to have a certain share under certain conditions. So the thought here would be to try to first find all the things that this libertarian and the social democrat agree on, which is more than people think, and then try to see what's morally suboptimal for them both and whether there's anything in that set in common. And the main way that we populate that set is by asking the libertarian and the social democrat, saying, okay, do you want to be at war with each other or not? Like, do you want to be able to trust each other or not? Because if you do, you're going to have to give. And the question is, you know, is there anything there? And I think there is. I think particularly private property for personal property for nonprofit associations like colleges, churches, for small mom and pops, I think there's a lot of agreement there. But it's the real disagreement comes to large concentrations of capital. And there, you know, you have to engage in more negotiation and compromise.
Good. Yeah. And there's a lot more in that second part that we just don't have time to get to. Yeah, this fascinating discussion about, bringing in public choice theory into contractarianism. And you have a great discussion about stability for the right reasons and supplementing Rawls there. And again, we'll just have to have you back on when you get the sequel and we can talk more. I wanted to finish by talking about, I mentioned at the beginning, there's a kind of broader frame for the project, which is for the book, which is about polarization in American politics. And I've sort of glancingly referred to this already. I'm imperative that what your book purports to do is provide some ways to address this polarization problem, to give, as you said just a few minutes ago, that give people reasons not to be at war with one another is a very noble goal. So there's this Notre Dame Philosophical Review of your book, which I thought I'd give you an opportunity to respond to, because it's in some way a really strange review. I mean, it's an interesting review, but it's a strange review. It's by a guy named Douglas Thomas. And why I say it's, I mean, it's a very intelligent review in the sense that, it's about, takes up this issue about polarization, which is the frame of your book, but it covers basically about four pages in your book. So
that's right,
the review, magnifies these four pages into an entire review. It says almost nothing about the rest of the book. Yeah. So that's why I say it's strange. But I do think maybe he has a point. So just to rephrase it and then sort of give you a chance to respond, which is I take it what his point is that, you know, the book purports to address polarization in American politics, and your response is in a way to sort of appeal to, you know, a moderate, at least moderately idealized contract theory. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways it seems like, I guess his term is, it's changing the subject. It's not referring to actually what, you know, the causes of polarization in America are, or it addresses, you know, forms of solutions. So I wonder how you address that.
Yeah. So there's sort of two steps, and they correspond with the two books. The point of Must Politics Be War is a kind of feasibility proof to show people who were saying, look, all there is political war, that they're in fact wrong about that. That when you articulate that problem, you could say, look, actually, liberal democratic order in general can furnish the rational basis for trust such that when people reflect on their order, they can see they have enough reason to go along with it and to sustain the bonds of trust within it. If I've pulled that off, that would be amazing. I mean, I almost certainly haven't, but if I, because who's ultimately right about these things? But that idea is just to show, look, must politics be war? Well, no, because here's the way in which a liberal order furnishes the basis for trust. So the idea is, if people say, look, we need to get rid of liberal democracy, I could say not so fast, because look, it has this unique trust generating property. But then the question becomes, okay, well, that may be true sort of in principle, which I'm like, that would be amazing if I had established this, because then they would say, well, you know, we don't have to be at war, but that's just hard to achieve. The next book comes along and looks at all the empirical data at a great length. So the whole second chapter of the next book is just a huge review of the trust literature and its relationships to various institutions. And there what I show is that the same institutions that can be publicly justified are the ones that help to create and sustain social and political trust in the real world with real folks. And in that, in the second book, I do talk a lot about real democratic politics at some length. The trouble was that my reviewer for OUP, who was wonderful, said, you know, this is a lot of material. You're young. People don't read big books by, you know, people that are well known. They're not going to read a 450-page book by someone who is, you know, early in his career. And so the reviewer suggested some ways in which the books could be split. And then it went through the review process. And so the sequel is also under contract and will come out next year. And there I give the empirical argument. So I say, the first book says, look, here's a feasibility proof. I mean, here's the thought that we can no longer say, oh no, politics is war, it's inevitable, so let's act like it is. We say, okay, no, actually, there is a liberal democratic solution. And now, oh, look, liberal democratic institutions in the real world help to create trust. Wow. So that is even more reason to think that politics doesn't have to be war. So this is why I call it the liberal democratic peace, creating trust in polarized times, is the name of the next book, where I say, look, you know, and I say at the very end in the epilogue, I ask some questions, you know, where do we go from here in terms of outlining the kinds of policies that would promote trust? And I think that there are policies that will address, that are kind of overlapping consensus policies, that I think that will advance a trust restoring and depolarizing a factor. Some things that are surprising, like I think real estate, national real estate reform laws, certain kinds of reforms of intellectual property laws. There's a lot of things that you would never think of initially. I think when you get in the research, it's a pretty good case that some of these policies would be not only healing, but that a lot of people could support. So I'm going to get, like I said, a lot more detail. But the point of this book is more to show people, look, politics isn't inevitably war. Like, stop saying that. You know, like, a liberal democratic peace is available to us. But I know I have to make more argument to make that empirically plausible. But I can make the argument, and I will. So that's the hope, anyway.
Yeah.
With a project.
Well, and a very impressive project, like I said at the beginning. I mean, very impressive philosophical arguments here and very impressive command of the range of empirical literature. So well done. And I look forward to the sequel, Kevin. And thank you for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Oh, thank you so much. It was wonderful.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.